Would you like to help a college or seminary student attend the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference? You can purchase a conference scholarship for a contribution of $120 to Issues Etc. You can donate online at issuesetc.org/scholarship, or you can make your $120 check payable to Issues Etc., write scholarship in the memo line, and send it to Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We'll be talking about how hard it is to shake certain ways of thinking if you are a child of the sexual revolution, if you came up believing what you were told by that first wave of feminists and the politicized feminists, if you believed it was your goal in life to make everything in your personal life a political issue. Those are hard ideas to shake, no matter how much you may want to shake them. Joining us to tell her story along those lines, Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse, founder and president of the Ruth Institute. She taught economics for 15 years at Yale and George Mason Universities. She's senior research fellow in economics for the Acton Institute and author of several books, including her latest, The Sexual Revolution and Its Victims, and a recent column for Crisis Magazine titled The Half-Made Bed and the More Excellent Way. Jennifer, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
So how would you describe yourself during your feminist days? Were you an all-in feminist? What kind of a feminist were you?
Oh, gosh, I was never an all-in feminist, Todd. At best, I was a skeptical feminist. And if you would call me a feminist at all, I was really more of a careerist type feminist. You know, I wanted to achieve the same kinds of academic and professional success that men did. That was the full extent of my commitment to feminism.
Despite your skepticism, you nonetheless apparently imbibed some of the basic ideas, some of them even kind of unstated ideas of feminism, such as what?
Well, that's right, Todd. I mean, I had the idea that, a couple of things. I mean, one that you and I have talked about on this show before is that I thought I was supposed to run my career and my education exactly the same way as a man would, and that would be the way that I would achieve what a man would achieve, because I knew enough economics to know that you don't just click your heels together three times and wish to be equal. You have to achieve equally, and that requires you to do certain things, you know, and to be committed to your work and all that. And one of the things that fed into that was the idea that I shouldn't have to do all the chores at home. I shouldn't have a second shift of work at home. My husband should be doing half of everything around the house so that we could be truly equals in the labor force. And here, so that whole line of thought opened up a whole can of worms on the domestic front, you know, in my married life, as opposed to, you know, how I was conducting myself in graduate school and on the job and so on. So it really has a way of infiltrating all of your thought process. If you're really trying to be equal, you got to be equal in everything. And that's not as innocent as it sounds.
You say that really led to, and it has in the lives of so many feminists or former feminists, the kind of politicizing of every personal detail of your life.
Well, you know, the feminists used to say the personal is political. And we should have listened to them when they said that, because they meant it, you see. And what they meant was that absolutely every detail of your life would become politicized, and that they meant to get into your life. They meant to be in your business. They meant to be sitting across the kitchen table from your husband and sitting in the back seat of your minivan. And, you know, they meant to be part of every aspect of your life. And indeed, you know, now 30, 40 years later, we can see that every aspect of life has been politicized, you know, right down to what you're allowed to say and think, not to mention how you raise your kids and how you conduct yourself at work.
Does that have the effect of essentially making even the smallest details of, you're talking here about domestic and married life, but even the smallest details, in essence, a battle for the cause?
Absolutely. If you're not careful, it'll turn into that. And that's what's so surprising about, you know, that's how I surprised myself, let's put it that way, because I never was a bra-burning, Betty Friedan-thumping type of feminist. I mean, I just wasn't. But what I took from feminism, that kind of feminism, was permission. Permission to nag my husband about every single job around the house, all the different chores and so on. Do we do it? You need to do half of everything I think is important. That's what I took it to mean. And I would feel cheated if he didn't do what I thought was important. I would feel like I would be put upon, like I'm being oppressed. Well, how am I ever going to make tenure if he's not helping? And all this type of stuff. And in the meantime, he's sitting over there looking at me like, this isn't even on his mind. It's not even on his radar, because, he's doing what guys do. He's doing the things that are important to him, like getting the oil change in the car and cleaning the gutters. And, he it's not like he was sitting around playing video games. Not that there were video games in those days, but, he was certainly doing his share and doing more than his share in a lot of respects. But I couldn't see that because I was so anxious, I guess is the right word, so anxious about myself and whether my dignity was somehow being affronted by me having to do too many dishes or me having to do too many, go to the laundromat too many times or something, somehow my dignity was at stake in all of that. And it took a long time to shake that off, Todd, a long time.
You talk about it in terms of what you call in your crisis article the equality paradigm or the way of equality. What do you mean by that?
Well, the equality paradigm that Betty Friedan and the National Organization for Women and that Gloria Steinem especially, that whole group of people and certainly academic feminists, what they were about was using equality as a battering ram to get people to do what they wanted and to lift themselves up and to always have some kind of complaint against the other person. And of course, if I have a complaint and I voice it loud enough, other people will give me what I want. But the cost of that, which they never seem to stop and think about, the cost of that is that you poison your relationships. And you can easily see that in the workplace, I think, when somebody who's demanding that you do everything their way, it's like, who wants to work with this person? Who wants to get, you can't get along with this person. Yes, everybody conforms to the court order that protects you and protects your rights, but you've kind of killed a lot of the collegiality that might have been there at the office. Well, it's 10 times worse at home. If we're making those types of demands on each other and saying, this is my due and I'm entitled and you need to help me because I helped you yesterday and I'm, by golly, I'm keeping score on everything. That just poisons the water. It just poisons the atmosphere of the home. And it literally crowds out love, which is the more excellent way, is the way of love. And the alternative to equality is the way of love. And that's what took me a long time and a lot of prayer and a lot of grace, really, to figure out.
You say that you viewed it as it was your job to advance your career. It was everyone else's job to help you. But what feminism did when it worked itself out there is it had a tendency to eliminate the number of people willing to help you.
Yeah, right. Well, see, that's right. You lose your helpers pretty fast. If you treat people like they owe you or you complain about how they do it, anybody who's not required to be there is going to soon be somewhere else. Your children will do what you make them do or tell them to do because you have authority over them and you're able to boss them around, but you're bigger and you're stronger and they're dependent on you. But, that's no way to parent, to demand things of your kids to make you comfortable. You demand things of your kids because they're to the benefit of the child or they're to the benefit of the whole family, but not to the benefit of my career particularly. That's twisted to think of it that way. Well, it's just as twisted to think about that, with respect to your life partner, to think, oh, honey, you're here to advance my career and make me feel good about myself. And, no, you're not that. No, that's not what it's about. I'm here to help you. You're here to help me. And we're here to work together and collaborate on what's important to us. And, things that are important to you become important to me because I care about you. And things that are important to me become important to him because he cares about me. And Todd, the irony of this thing is that now, because I learned this, quite a long time ago, really, the kids, of course, forced us to learn it. But because I learned this, we didn't get divorced. which could have easily happened, you know, if I had persisted, if I hadn't changed, and thereby he changed as well. I left the labor force. I quit worrying about equality. I did what needed to be done inside the home. I tried the best I could to follow the way of love. And now that he's nearing retirement and I'm running the Ruth Institute, he's the biggest booster ever of the Ruth Institute. You know, he'll do all kinds of things for me that have nothing to do with equality or keeping track or keeping score or anything like that. He helps me because he's proud of what I'm doing and he's happy for me and he wants me to be happy. And it's just a whole different way of ordering your life together, you know, to start from the premise that we're here to help each other rather than starting from the premise that we're here to compete with one another. And by golly, he's really secretly trying to take advantage of me, and my job is to be suspicious of him all the time. Just completely different way of living your life together.
Golly, how many marriages have been ruined by that equality paradigm, making my personal life political issues?
There's no way of knowing that. I mean, Todd, we don't even know how many marriages end against the will of one party. You know, we don't even keep track of that. So we have no idea. But judging from my mail and from the comments that I got over at the Crisis Magazine website there, and judging from the Ruth Institute Facebook page and my personal Facebook page, I'm not the only person who did this. That is for sure. You know, I feel quite certain that I'm not the only one to do this. And my hope is that people will share this with one another so that people who are in the middle of making a mess can step back from it and realize, you know, hey, there is a better way here. Because the people who tend to write to me, Todd, are people who have already figured it out, you know, who go, yeah, wow, I saw that too. I didn't put it that way, but yeah, that's exactly what I was doing too. So those people have, you know, by the grace of God, rescued themselves. But it's the people starting their married lives now who maybe are still enthralled to this thing and who don't realize that that's who we're hoping, of course, to reach, you know, before they make a big mess of things.
So how hard is it to shake these ideas? Do you still find yourself trying to shake them?
Oh, gosh, you know, every once in a while that script will still run, Todd. It'll still run. You know, the reason I called the article The Half-Made Bed is because sometimes if my husband makes the bed, he doesn't make it the way I would do it. And I have to stop myself from thinking, because I don't even want to think these things. You know, I have learned to keep my mouth shut and not blurt this out at him. So I learned to do that a long time ago. But truly, I don't even want it in my mind. I don't even want, you know, it's poisoning my whole brain, you know, but I have to say to myself, okay, he didn't do it the way I would like it, but he did it. And I didn't nag him. I didn't ask him. And I'm so grateful that he cares about me because he knows I care. And he did this because he knows I care about it, you know, and not because I nagged him. And I'm grateful to him and I appreciate it. Sometimes I have to admit it is a conscious effort even now to get that, to say those things to myself. But the good news is, Todd, anybody listening to me can change their own self-talk. If you make a decision that your first priority in your family, whether you're married or whether it's with your kids or whether it's with your brothers and sisters or your adult parents or whatever it might be, you can make a decision to change your self-talk from the idea that everybody owes me to the idea that I'm here to bring as much love as I can into the family. That's what we're here to do, is to love one another.
There's a real contrast there, isn't there? With about a minute, what you're saying in essence is that feminism came into many women's lives at the cost of love.
Yes, yes. In fact, the modern world itself has no place for love, Todd, when you really think about it, because we're all supposed to be rational, autonomous, independent, self-reliant, you know, and if we're dependent on anybody, that's bad, 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 right? But the whole point of the family and the whole point of love is that we're radically dependent on one another, and the modern world can't even see that. So a lot of our political ideologies are undermining that more excellent way that St. Paul talks about in 1 Corinthians, the way of love.
How nice is it, finally, to not have to make every little issue in your marriage and your family a political issue, another little battle for the cause?
It's a relief. That's all I can say, Todd. It's a relief to let go of all that stuff.
Dr. Jennifer Roback Morris is founder and president of the Ruth Institute. You can meet and hear her making the case at the Winter Issues, Etc., Making the Case conference. She's going to be making the case against the sexual revolution. That's held Friday, November the 10th, and Saturday, November the 11th in Houston, Texas. Attendance is limited to 400, and you'll find additional details on our winter conference, November 10th and 11th, and our summer conference, June 9th and 10th in Collinsville, Illinois, at issuesetc.org. You can also call for more information and to register, 618-223-8385. Dr. Jennifer Roback Morris taught economics for 15 years at Yale and George Mason Universities. She's Senior Research Fellow in Economics for the Acton Institute and author of several books, including her latest, The Sexual Revolution and Its Victims, and a recent column for Crisis titled The Half-Made Bed and the More Excellent Way. Read it under the Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org. Jennifer, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Todd.
When we come back, Pastor Hans Feeney joins us. We're going to talk about some on-screen villains. He's found a few in a new TV program that he says are the best villains ever. We'll find out why.
Athanasius, Bishop of Alexandria in the 4th century, was known for boldly confessing Jesus Christ as both true God and true man. This is what we do at St. Athanasius Lutheran Church in Vienna, Virginia, just outside Washington, D.C., continuing this historic confession of our Savior, who died for us and now comes to us in word and sacrament. If you live in the D.C. area or just visiting, come join us. For more information, find us on the web, St. Athanasius Lutheran Church.
The number of recent Christian martyrs is staggering. 90,000 Christians are estimated to have died for the faith in the past year alone. Wondering what to think and how to prepare to endure persecution yourself? Check out Mays, The Lutheran Witness, for insight on memorizing the scriptures, learning from the early church martyrs, and looking to Christ on the cross for comfort. Not a subscriber? Visit cph.org/trylutheranwitness for a special offer. $6.99 for 6 digital or print issues. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran perspective.
Solid. Serious. Substantive. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. St. John Lutheran, Springfield, Pennsylvania. Zion Lutheran, Detroit, Michigan. St. Paul's Lutheran, Long Beach, California. All Saints Lutheran, Charlotte, North Carolina. Redeemer Lutheran, Colorado Springs, Colorado. Shepherd of the Lake Lutheran, Garrison, Minnesota. Emmanuel Lutheran, Kansas City, Missouri. And Holy Cross Lutheran, St. Genevieve, Missouri. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, and click support. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll advertise your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. Journal. Issuesetc.org. Click support. The Issues Etc. 300.